Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 12th, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Putin plays peacemaker in Ukraine. What happened? Russian President Vladimir Putin said he and his Ukrainian counterpart were close to agreeing on a ceasefire plan for war-torn eastern Ukraine this week, with Moscow proposing an end to the fast-moving rebel offensive and the withdrawal of government forces. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said he supported Putin's push for a peaceful resolution to the crisis and was prepared to hold talks with separatists. If Poroshenko agrees to the deal, it would be a stark reversal of fortune for Kiev, which just weeks ago appeared close to defeating the Russian-backed rebels it has battled since mid-April. But early last week, the Ukrainian military began suffering a series of crushing defeats on the battlefield, following what officials in Kiev and the West say was a massive influx of Russian troops, tanks, and artillery from across the border. Moscow has repeatedly denied sending any men or material to the rebels. But in a phone call with a senior European Union official last week, Putin reportedly boasted that he could take Kiev in 2 weeks if he wanted. The Kremlin claimed the comments were taken out of context. Putin announced his ceasefire plan as leaders from NATO countries held a summit in Wales, where they were expected to approve the creation of a high readiness force of about 4,000 troops, capable of deploying to any member state in 48 hours. Speaking during a visit to Estonia, a NATO member and Russian neighbor, President Obama said the alliance would defend all its members from the kind of brazen assault Russia was carrying out in Ukraine. Borders, he said, cannot be redrawn at the barrel of a gun. What the editorial said. Putin has won this round, said the Wall Street Journal. The surge of Russian troops not only stopped Ukraine's offensive in the east, but it also allowed Moscow-backed separatists to grab a swath of southern Ukraine, the first step to Russia acquiring a land bridge to Crimea, which Putin annexed in March. He's been able to get away with all this because Europe and the Obama administration have refused to arm the Ukrainians so they can defend themselves. This isn't a total victory for Putin, said USA Today. Far from splintering Europe apart or driving it away from the U.S., he has pushed the alliance closer together. NATO has a renewed sense of purpose, and Europe now accepts that the cost of imposing economic sanctions on Russia is a burden it has to shoulder. The West may not be able to stop Putin's imperial ambitions, but it can raise the price for Russia. What the columnist said. Putin has, yet again, found a way to play his opponents, said Mark Champion in BloombergView.com. While he has agreed to the framework of a ceasefire with Kiev, he also said Russia cannot sign off on the deal because Moscow is not a party to the conflict. By claiming that only the supposedly independent Ukrainian rebels, who in fact take their orders from Moscow, are able to agree to a ceasefire, Putin can still keep the conflict alive if he wishes. Poroshenko really has no choice but to accept this humiliating peace deal, said Michael Rubin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Even if Ukrainian forces were somehow able to fight the rebels and their Russian allies to a standstill, Putin would simply continue the war by other means. Ukraine remains overwhelmingly dependent upon Russian gas shipments. So if the Russian strongman still hasn't got what he wants by winter, he can freeze Ukrainians into submission. Putin's thuggery in Ukraine is not, in itself, a cataclysmic historical event, said David Brooks in the New York Times. But he is a threat to our civilizational order. and that's even more frightening. The autocrat has violated the international norm that big nations don't gobble everything around them just because they can. If the West and NATO don't stand up to Putin now, other territory-hungry countries such as China will be emboldened, and more we'll live in a world in which brazenness is rewarded and self-restraint is punished. We'll take in a second main story this week. The hunt for a hacking ring. The FBI launched an investigation into a major celebrity privacy breach this week after hackers stole nude photographs from the personal accounts of actress Jennifer Lawrence, model Kate Upton, and dozens of other female stars and published the images online. Though some of the celebrities claimed the photos were completely fake, others, including Lawrence, vowed to take criminal action over the flagrant privacy violation. To those of you looking at photos I took with my husband years ago in the privacy of our home, tweeted actress Mary E. Winstead, I hope you feel great about yourselves. Apple denied suggestions that the leak was a result of a breach of the company's iCloud system, and the FBI is investigating whether an underground hacking ring may have used phishing techniques to trick the victims into handing over their Apple passwords. An anonymous forum user allegedly involved in the hack said it had been several months in the making. I can't seem to work up any kind of outrage over this scandal, said Robin Abkarian in the Los Angeles Times. Granted, it must be embarrassing for these celebrities to have their nude selfies splashed all over the internet. But who in this day and age hasn't heard of electronic piracy or internet theft? It's pretty damn simple. If you don't want people to see your naked body, don't pose naked for photos that could be vulnerable to theft. While we're at it, don't leave the house, said Peggy Drexler in CNN.com. After all, you could get mugged or raped, and by the same ridiculous logic, you'd be to blame for that too. Let's stop acting as if this week's hacking job was just a humiliating privacy breach. It's flat-out criminal invasion, and should be treated as such. Still, even we plebeians can learn from this scandal, said Leonid Bershidsky in BloombergView.com. If any of us bothered to read the small print on Apple's cloud service before snapping away to our phones and tablets, we'd know that technology companies ultimately take no responsibility for our data. And you don't have to be a Hollywood star to worry about that. After all, even the unlikeliest people can eventually become the targets of stalkers, governments, and other unwanted watchers. But it wasn't all bad. A San Francisco bicycle mechanic has been donating his time teaching kids in low-income neighborhoods how to repair their bikes. Tommy Bensko, 33, started Bike Mobile in 2011, traveling to schools and community centers to fix bikes for free and give kids a hands-on education about basic repairs. When I was 10 years old, my bike got a flat tire and nobody was there to fix it, Bensko said. This is about empowering people to take things into their own hands. The work is rewarding in more ways than one. I've probably taught 100 children to ride bikes, he said. And it never gets old. Our controversy of the week, taking on ISIS. Does Obama have a strategy? It's a rare moment when the President of the United States publicly admits he doesn't know how to deal with a major foreign policy crisis, said Stuart Stevens in thedailybeast.com. Yet last week, President Obama did just that. Asked during a press conference whether he would deal with the rise of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria by attacking the militant group's strongholds in Syria, Obama replied, "We don't have a strategy yet." With that one phrase, said Peter Werner in WSJ.com, Obama laid bare the vacillation and cowardice that have characterized his foreign policy. Having drawn and then erased a red line over Syria and ignored Russia's creeping invasion of Ukraine, the president has now declared he doesn't have a clue how to deal with the best armed, best funded terrorist group on earth. Never mind that ISIS controls an area the size of Belgium stretching from Syria to Iraq, or that its fighters are beheading American journalists and burying their enemies alive. Really, what's the rush? Obama's choice of words was unfortunate, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com. But he does have a strategy for dealing with ISIS. We've already seen it in action in Iraq, where the president has launched airstrikes to protect imperiled religious groups and bolster Kurdish forces battling Sunni militants on the ground. When Obama said he didn't yet have a strategy, he was talking specifically of his reluctance to intervene militarily in Syria, where, unlike Iraq, the ruling government of President Bashar al-Assad is hostile toward the U.S., and there are no obvious allies. Obama is right to tread carefully in Syria, said Fred Hoff in NewRepublic.com. For Assad, an opportunity knocks. There's nothing the Syrian president would like more than for U.S. fighter jets to pound ISIS positions in his country's east, destroying the dictator's strongest opponents and leaving his own forces free to focus on bombing, shelling, and starving rebellious civilians. But America can no longer pretend Iraq and Syria are two separate countries, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. ISIS certainly doesn't recognize the border. And to pummel the extremist militants in Iraq while allowing the group to retreat into its Syrian stronghold would be as self-defeating a policy as it is incoherent. No one is suggesting that Obama put American boots on the ground, said Max Boot, also in CommentaryMagazine.com. There are other actions the president can take, such as arming the more moderate rebels in Syria, who are also fighting against ISIS. But that would require Obama to start acting, rather than engaging in an endless faculty club debate of the kind this law professor turned president seems to prefer. The president's hesitancy is understandable, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. After the U.S. wasted so much blood and treasure in Iraq and Afghanistan, most Americans are wary of another Middle Eastern intervention. Moreover, it's not even clear that U.S. military action in Syria would help. In Libya, Western airstrikes helped topple dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi, but created a vacuum that's been filled by Islamic insurgents and warring tribes. Still, at a time when rampaging ISIS militants are executing Americans, crucifying infidels, and selling off women as sex slaves, the leader of the last remaining superpower cannot publicly shrug and tell the world he's working on it. Nor should he be defensively reminding us the world has always been messy. One has to wonder, is this president consoling us or himself? Well, it was a good week for building interest in art after a German artist buried $16,000 in gold bullion at an English beach as a part of an art installation and then encouraged locals to hunt for the hidden booty. I think we might well have a lot of people, said one of the event's organizers. It was a good week for single men after a feminist commune in Brazil that is populated by 600 women appealed for bachelors to move to the town. I haven't kissed a man for a long time, said Nelma Fernandez, 23. It was a good week for journalism after Chelsea Clinton announced that she was leaving her special correspondent job with NBC News, where she was paid $600,000 a year, 14 times the average reporter's salary, even though she had no journalistic experience and filed only a handful of reports. It was a bad week for nominative determinism after a Utah woman whose last name is Crispy was arrested when she allegedly tried to burn down her ex-boyfriend's house by leaving a pound of bacon on a lit stove. Police charged Cameo Crispy, 32, with arson and burglary. It was a bad week for the 50 Mile High Club. After five geckos that were sent into orbit so Russian scientists could study the effect of weightlessness on their sex lives, died before reentering Earth's atmosphere. The geckos froze, said a researcher. And it was a bad week for one-upsmanship. After a Belgian man was knocked unconscious when a friend dropped 400 gallons of water on him from a firefighting plane as part of the ice bucket challenge. They obviously miscalculated how much water it was, said a witness. Over on the briefing page, kidnapping for jihad. Islamist terrorists are funding their operation with ransom money. How did kidnapping Westerners become so lucrative? Who's doing the kidnapping? Most of the Islamic terrorist groups. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, recently brought attention to terrorist kidnappings with its gruesome beheading of American journalist James Foley. The terrorist group claimed the execution was in retaliation for U.S. airstrikes, but it also had demanded the huge sum of $132 million for Foley's release. In recent months, ISIS has secured millions of dollars for the release of other hostages, a tactic it adopted from Al-Qaeda, from which it split in February. Al-Qaeda's three main affiliates, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and Al-Shabaab, have helped extract an estimated $165 million for hostages since 2008. Kidnapping for ransom has become today's most significant source of terrorist financing, said David S. Cohen, the U.S. Secretary of Department's Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. When did Al-Qaeda turn to kidnapping? The terrorist group used to rely on donations from wealthy sympathizers. But as the West clamped down on that revenue stream, freezing bank accounts and killing Al-Qaeda financiers with drone attacks, the leadership pivoted toward kidnapping. From 2008 to 2009, the number of hostages taken in Afghanistan surged from 584 to 2,088. In Pakistan, it rose from 1,264 to 3,366. The real pioneers, though, were Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM. In 2003, the group snatched up 32 European tourists in a series of raids in the Algerian desert. Expecting the operation to last just 2 weeks, the kidnappers were almost comically incompetent. They quickly ran out of food and fuel and left their ransom note under a rock in the middle of the desert. Still, European governments eventually coughed up $6.5 million. AQIM invested this in better equipment and set about perfecting the art of kidnapping Westerners. What is the group's modus operandi? Rather than chasing high-value targets like government officials or corporate executives, AQIM takes anyone and everyone, journalists, aid workers, tourists, and demands ransoms from the hostages' governments. AQIM outsources the kidnapping itself to local criminals. Once they have the hostage, they drive them deep into the desert, where they have hidden food, fuel, and spare tires that can be relocated using GPS. One AQIM hostage, Italian tourist Marisandra Mariani, saw her captors dig an entire vehicle out of a dune. It was then, she said, that I realized these aren't just normal criminals. The kidnappers use satellite phones to start negotiating with families, employers, and governments, a process that takes months or even years and often ends with the delivery of a suitcase of cash. AQIM's methods have been so successful that they've distilled into an online manual for other terrorist groups. And the rewards are getting bigger. In 2003, the hostage taking generated about $200,000. Today, it's up to $10 million. Why the inflated price? As governments keep paying ransoms, it encourages the terrorists to take more hostages and ask for more money. Last year, the G8 nations signed a declaration agreeing not to pay, but most European countries have been breaking that promise, channeling money through aid agencies or the victims' employers to afford the government plausible deniability. France, one of the biggest culprits, has paid for the release of at least 10 hostages, reportedly forking over more than double any other nation. This hasn't escaped al-Qaeda's notice. Of the 53 people abducted by the group and its affiliates in the past 5 years, a third were French. Hostages are an investment, said Jean-Paul Roulier, director of the Geneva Center for Training and Analysis of Terrorism. You are not going to invest unless you are pretty sure of a payout. Which countries don't pay? The U.S., Britain, and Poland. While the U.S. and the U.K. occasionally negotiate with terrorist groups, the prisoner swap involving Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, for example, neither pays ransoms. As a result, terrorists kidnap far fewer Americans and British citizens. But the cost of that policy is that those who are captured are often executed. In 2009, AQIM kidnapped 4 tourists, a German woman, a Swiss couple, and a British man named Edwin Dyer, on their way back from a music festival in Mali. When the British government point-blank refused to pay, Dyer was executed. The others were released for a reported $10.4 million. It seems Britain gives little importance to its citizens, the kidnappers sneered. Do British and American hostages ever survive? Occasionally, instead of paying out, the U.S. and U.K. often try to recover captives by force. The U.S. tried to rescue James Foley, but when Special Forces troops landed in Syria and conducted a fierce firefight with ISIS militants, they found he'd been moved to another location. Some raids, however, have been successful. Sometimes an intermediary helped secure a hostage's freedom. Qatar, which often acts as a go-between for kidnappers and governments, negotiated the release of American journalist Peter Theo Curtis last week without a ransom. But as long as other governments continue paying, the problem will only worsen. Ransom payments lead to future kidnappings, said Cohen, the U.S. Treasury official. Refusing to pay ransoms is, clearly, the surest way to break the cycle. The rise of kidnapping insurance. Governments aren't the only ones paying ransoms. Kidnap and ransom insurance, KNR, has become a huge industry. About 75% of Fortune 500 companies hold KNR policies. Premiums run as high as $10,000 a day and can cover a multitude of costs. A crisis response team, psychiatric treatment, even a reward for informants. Yet most people with KNR probably don't even know they have it. Terrorists might target people they know are insured or extract a higher ransom from insurers. So many policies explicitly forbid employers from telling employees they're covered. For that reason, the vast majority of cases involving KNR are never reported to governments or reach the media. Taryn Evans, an analyst for securities consultant AKE Group, says dozens of people covered by her company are abducted every month. About 1/10 of those cases are reported, she said. We handle the rest. And we'll take a look at a few columns. 2 from the U.S. this week. The first comes from Garrett Epps at theatlantic.com. Roberts' Partisan Court. Early in his tenure, Chief Justice John Roberts spoke of his desire to lead a Supreme Court that would unite the nation, said Garrett Epps. Nearly a decade later, that dream seems to have melted into air. In all 3 high-profile cases of the 2013 term, on campaign finance, public employee unions, and the Affordable Care Act's contraceptive mandate, Roberts' court produced bitterly partisan 5-4 rulings. In each case, the five Republican-appointed justices jumped aboard causes championed by the Republican Party, while the four Democratic-appointed colleagues filed furious dissents laying bare the court's partisan divide. In the court's decision to allow the Christian owners of a crafts company, Hobby Lobby, to be exempt from the ACA's contraceptive mandate, the conservative justices essentially gave private companies the right to secede from federal law. In effect, America can no longer simply be divided into red and blue states, but also red and blue companies. Whether the issue is contraception, labor unions, campaign finance limits, or voting rights, the party identity of the justices seems to be the single most important determinant of their votes. The Supreme Court Roberts once hoped would bridge the partisan gap is now clearly divided into red and blue justices. And this from Julian Zelizer at CNN.com. Romney in 2016? It's possible. It may have sounded impossible a year ago, said Julian Zelizer, but it's not crazy to think the Republican presidential nominee in 2016 will be none other than Mitt Romney. The former Massachusetts governor's political career seemed to be over when he lost to President Obama in 2012. But Romney has been proven right on several issues, such as his insistence that Russia remains the U.S.'s formidable enemy. And with the economy still sluggish, one poll recently found that Romney would beat Obama 53-44% if there were a rerun of the election. Other potential Republican contenders, including New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Wisconsin Governor Scott Wallace, have been damaged by scandal, while Representative Paul Ryan is closely associated with the extremely unpopular House Republican caucus. Last week, Romney said he has no intention of running, but noted that circumstances can change. If he were to announce, major conservative donors like the Koch brothers would immediately line up behind him. Stranger things have happened in politics. After Richard Nixon lost to JFK in 1960, he snarled to the press, "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore." 8 years later, he was elected president. In an international column from China, Hong Kong's promise of democracy betrayed. So much for one country, two systems, said Peter Kammerer in Hong Kong's South China Morning Post. When Britain handed Hong Kong back to China in 1997, it was with the agreement that the territory would retain its own political system, including protection of free speech and assembly, and would move toward universal suffrage by 2017. Now it turns out that although Beijing will honor the letter of that agreement, it has gutted the spirit. China's powerful National People's Congress Standing Committee has ruled that while all Hong Kongers will be allowed to vote for their chief executive, they must choose from a slate of candidates handpicked by Beijing. Worse, the committee said the central government has full jurisdiction over the city. That means Beijing can overturn any law passed by Hong Kong's legislature and demand that our supposedly independent judges pass an unspecified test of patriotism. Even our free press is being muzzled. Pro-democracy leaflets explaining the principle of universal suffrage have been confiscated by the post office. Hong Kong is now under the Communist Party's thumb. Two systems or not. All Hong Kongers are weeping together, said Min Chin Pai in Hong Kong's Apple Daily. Many of our parents and grandparents came to Hong Kong when it was a British protectorate, specifically to flee the Chinese Communist Party. We were aware that treachery is the essence of CCP. Yet still the committee's ruling shocked us and left us angry, disappointed, and despondent. Still, we will not give up. Thousands of people rallied in protest this week, and university students are planning to boycott classes. In the words of another civil rights movement, we shall overcome. Hong Kongers will stand together and work toward our promised democracy. Why aren't they satisfied? Asked Beijing's China Daily in an editorial. Never before have Hong Kongers been offered so much democracy. Universal suffrage was not their right under London rule, but Beijing now offers it. Yet some radicals are still not satisfied. These extremists are threatening to paralyze central Hong Kong's financial district by illegally occupying it with thousands of protesters who want the right to pick their own candidates in line with a so-called international standards of democracy. This is a disruptive, reckless political gamble. They'll back down, said Beijing's Hun Kui Xiaobo. Now that the central government has made clear its attitude, Hong Kongers know there is no hope to fight until the end, as vowed by the opposition. They hope for Western help, but China's national strength means the West will not easily interfere. Sensible Hong Kongers will soon quit the Occupy Central movement, knowing that otherwise they will be crushed. Not many will want to follow these radical opposition figures in sacrificing themselves. The title of the Last Word article this week is The Need for Speed. Racing is in Danny Thompson's blood, says Ann O'Neill. And at 64, he's gunning for a land speed record. Danny Thompson is trying to become the fastest driver of a piston engine car, just like his dad, Mickey Thompson. When the temperature dances around the century mark and the horizon shimmers over the Utah desert at Mike Cook's Bonneville Shootout, beginning September 12th, Danny Thompson will squeeze into a cigar on four wheels that he has rebuilt by hand and rage across the desert floor faster than a 747 at takeoff. When his turn comes, he will lie almost flat, his body mere inches from the earth, in a space the size of a coffin. He will see blinding white light ahead, noxious fumes will tease his nostrils, and he will hold onto the steering wheel for dear life. 70 seconds, that's all it will take. Spectators who cluster at the 3-mile mark, about 2 miles from the finish line, will spot a tiny dot and a rooster tail of salt in the distance. Then, because light travels faster than sound, a few seconds later they'll hear what sounds like a hive of angry bees. In his mind, there can be just one outcome. Danny Thompson will hold a land speed record, driving faster than 439 miles per hour, maybe 450, maybe even 500 to hold on to the record for good. He'll be the master of a tiny universe, one of just a dozen men to top 400 miles per hour in a piston engine car. His father, Mickey, was one of racing's early giants, an innovator who tasted both success and failure. He became the first American to top 400 miles per hour back in 1960, but a technicality kept him out of the record books. Mickey was 32 then. Danny will be twice that age, and he doubts more than a few people will notice his feat, no matter how fast he goes. Danny first seriously thought about restoring his father's race car, Challenger 2, 4 years ago, on the 50th anniversary of Mickey's record-breaking run. It had been on his mind for a while, and he wasn't getting any younger. That was about $2 million ago. His retirement savings are gone. The 401k shot all to hell. He's flat broke, not sure where his next dime will come from. He prays for a sponsor to magically appear. But the truth is, he's never been happier. He can't wait to get up in the morning and go to work. No 64-year-old should feel this frisky. Racing is in Danny Thompson's blood. He idolized his hot rodder father, an icon of Southern California's car culture whose motto was, "Stand on the gas." As he grew up, all Danny wanted to do was race cars. By the time he was 9, he was entering events in the quarter midget class at Lyons, a drag strip his father managed outside Long Beach, California. Kids drove race cars a quarter the size of adult cars around a track Mickey built behind the grandstand. When Danny won his first heat, he was pumped with pride and hoped Mickey would be too. But that's not the reaction he got. Mickey sprinted from the other side of the track, leaping over the bales of hay lining the course. He yanked Danny out of the car. "That's the last time you'll race, ever," he told his son. Someone had given Mickey bad information, told him Danny had flipped the car and was hurt. Mickey's reaction was purely visceral. He knew one thing. He didn't want his boy to die in a race car. Mickey had lost 8 friends racing and was haunted by 2 tragedies from early in his own career. He veered off course into the crowd at a sharp curve during the 321-mile mountain leg of the Mexican road race in 1953. Killing 5 spectators. A decade later, Dave McDonald, a rookie driver who was under contract with Mickey, slammed into the wall coming out of the fourth turn at the 1964 Indianapolis 500. He was incinerated in the crash, which also killed driver Eddie Sachs. Mickey Thompson held more speed records than anyone else. He brought off-road racing out of the deserts and into the arenas of big cities across America. It made him a millionaire, but he never got over those deadly crashes, especially the one at Indy. Like most fathers, Mickey wanted more for his son: a better education, bigger opportunities, a step up from the working class. And so he did everything he could to thwart Danny's racing dream. Eventually, Mickey's refusal to let Danny race came between them. Danny pleaded his case almost every day, but Mickey didn't budge. Danny rebelled. They fought about everything. At 18, when Danny decided to pursue his dream and race motorcycles, he quietly moved out of the house. Mickey would call and ask how he was doing, and he'd just say he was working hard. He won his first 18 races. Mickey eventually found out about the racing from someone else and showed up unannounced at an event. Danny couldn't tell whether his father was angry or proud. He won the first race and then, distracted, crashed in the second. After that, Mickey begrudgingly accepted that he couldn't stop his son. But Danny's career never really took off. He sensed that his father was working against him behind the scenes. His mother, who by then was divorced from Mickey, later confirmed his suspicions. By the end of 1987, Mickey was starting to come around to the idea of seeing his son behind the wheel of a race car. He came to Danny with an offer he couldn't refuse. "Let's take the Challenger to Bonneville and go for that land speed record." He asked Danny to drive. Mickey went 406.6 miles per hour at Bonneville in 1960. But because Challenger 1 broke down on the return lap, he never made it into the official record books. At Bonneville, a driver has to go out and back within an hour and average the speed of both trips. Otherwise, it doesn't count. Today, racers drive jet-powered cars much faster. The current land speed record stands at 763 miles per hour. And jets are where the glory is. But purists still see the beauty in doing it the old-fashioned way, with a piston engine, the same way you drive to work, as Danny puts it. The year 1988 was the end of a huge impasse between father and son. It was going to be the Thompson year. "I get goosebumps when I talk about it because that was a real coming together," said Danny. Several years earlier, Mickey had found a partner to help him run his thriving racing companies, which made high-performance parts and racing tires. Michael Frank Goodwin, a charismatic former rock promoter who'd put on tours for Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones, had popularized motocross, arena spectator exhibitions at which drivers race motorcycles over obstacle courses. But no partnership can survive 2 alpha dogs, and the merger was doomed from the start. Mickey accused Goodwin of failing to hold up his end of the deal, so became a 4-year court battle that became known in racing circles as the feud. Mickey prevailed in court, but he was never one to just beat an opponent. He had to crush him. He was relentless in his efforts to collect from Goodwin, who was equally determined not to pay Mickey a dime. When Mickey persuaded a judge to seize Goodwin's Mercedes, he drove the car to the courthouse the next day just to rub Goodwin's nose in it. Goodwin appealed the case all the way to California's Supreme Court. He lost. To avoid paying, Goodwin filed for bankruptcy and put everything in his wife's name. Mickey started telling people he was getting death threats. If anything happened to him or his second wife, Trudy, Mickey would say, Mike Goodwin was behind it. Danny was on his way to work early on March 16, 1988, when he heard the news on his car radio. Mickey and his wife had been gunned down, execution style. From day one, Goodwin wasn't talking to the cops. It took nearly 19 years for authorities to build and prove the case against him. Murder charges were filed in June 2004. Goodwin was convicted in January 2007. To this day, Goodwin maintains he is innocent, the target of a vast corrupt conspiracy. Because the evidence against him was circumstantial, some people still doubt his guilt. Danny Thompson is not one of them. It was a sad deal, he said about his father's murder and the long journey to the trial. By the time the verdict came, Danny had retired from racing, thrown everything into storage, and moved to Colorado. People say, well, you have closure now that Goodwin's in jail. You don't have any of that. There is no closure. Closure is my dad standing here. His father's murder knocked him down flat. He had grown up in the shadow of a larger-than-life personality, been denied his dream, and finally gotten the validation he'd been waiting for, only to have his dream of a father-son racing team snatched away. I didn't do anything for a long time, he said. My dad's been gone 26 years. I didn't feel right about doing it without him. The flats occupy about 30,000 acres in western Utah, stretching from the Great Salt Lake nearly to the Nevada border. They're the remnants of a salt lake that dried up during the Pleistocene era. Drivers fondly refer to the flats as the Great White Dino, a play on a dynamometer, a device used to measure engine power. The place is just magic, Danny said. The Great White Dino and the 50th anniversary of Mickey's claim to fame got Danny thinking about their unfinished business. He's ready to stake his own claim. I'll be 65 soon, and I've still got the passion to drive, he said. There's not many things you can still go and do as a race car driver, and Bonneville is one of them. I want to be the baddest man there. Right now, George Potter is the baddest man, at least in Danny's class. Poteet said set the current land speed record for the piston engine car, 439 miles per hour, last year's speed week. It's a tough needle to move if you consider that Mickey Thompson went just 33 miles per hour slower half a century ago. To clinch the record for the Thompson family name, Danny thinks he'll have to top 450 miles per hour. He'd like to hit 500, and he thinks Challenger 2 is up to the task. The first Bonneville record he's going for, 392.5 miles per hour for Challenger 2's vehicle class, is within sight. Then come Poteet's world record. But Poteet probably isn't Danny's biggest competition. It's the guy he says he's doing this for, Mickey Thompson. This time, the son is meeting the father on his own terms, as an equal. This article came from CNN.com, copyright 2014. Take a look now at the health and science page. Ocean currents slowing climate change. Global warming has been slowing down, and a new study may have found the cause, reports NationalGeographic.com. Over the past 60 years, average global surface temperatures have been rising at a rate of approximately 0.12 degrees Celsius every decade. Beginning in 1998, that rate slowed to an average of 0.05 degrees per decade, prompting many skeptics to claim that warnings about catastrophic climate change have been hyped. But researchers at the University of Washington, who used dozens of underwater sensors, have concluded that the pause in global warming is illusory, and that the additional heat is being stored in the Atlantic Ocean, but only temporarily. Roughly 90% of the Earth's heat is absorbed by the oceans. Since the late 1990s, the study found cyclical changes in the tropical current, combined with unusually strong trade winds, have acted as a conveyor belt and carried surface warmth more than 1,000 feet deep into the Atlantic. This process, researchers say, will last until around 2030, when the 30-year current cycle ends and atmospheric temperatures will resume climbing very rapidly. The frightening part, says study co-author Kakit Tung, is that it's going to warm just as fast as the last three decades of the 20th century, which was the fastest warming we've seen. Even though global warming has slowed, 13 of the 14 warmest years on record have occurred since 2000, according to UN estimates. New hope for aging eyes. Having trouble keeping track of your reading glasses? Soon enough, you may not have to. A new surgical procedure being tested in the UK uses a tiny implant to change the shape of the cornea and improve natural focus on up-close objects. Developed in the U.S. by researchers at Revision Optics in California, the raindrop inlay, which is no longer than the head of a pin, is inserted into the cornea. The procedure is virtually painless, takes about 10 minutes to complete, and, if approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration, could replace laser surgery as the most practical long-term solution to presbyopia, the natural flattening of the lens that occurs with aging. Made from hydrogel, the water-based substance used in contact lenses, the device is more compatible with the eye than previous implants. Raindrop can't stop eyes from aging, Dr. Mike Wevel, a UK-based ophthalmic surgeon who has performed the procedure, tells telegraph.co.uk, but it can help correct the natural deterioration in eyesight caused by the aging process. The health scare of the week. E-cig's empty promises. When e-cigarettes came onto the mass market a few years ago, they were hailed as a healthy way to help smokers cut their habits. But are these battery-powered gadgets, which heat nicotine-laced liquid into vapor, as safe as manufacturers claim? The World Health Organization has produced its most detailed report yet, and the news for vapors is not good, the Wall Street Journal reports. Citing concerns over the level of chemicals and pollutants in secondhand vapor, the WHO is calling for a total ban on indoor use in public spaces, as well as heavy restrictions on advertising. The report said manufacturers shouldn't be allowed to claim that e-cigarettes help people give up smoking, since there is no evidence that this is the case, and recommended banning child-friendly fruit and candy flavors. While the researchers acknowledge that vaping is probably less harmful than smoking, they warn that e-cigarettes could pose health threats to adolescents and the fetuses of pregnant women and could serve as a gateway to cigarettes. On the Talking Points page, ISIS, Americans' homegrown jihadists. Douglas MacArthur McCain's life was one slice of Americana after another, said Terrence McCoy in WashingtonPost.com. Raised outside Minneapolis, the young Midwesterner was an avid Chicago Bulls fan who loved pizza and longed to become a famous rapper. But then McCain's life took an unexpected route. The 33-year-old converted to Islam while hanging out with members of Minnesota's Somali community and was recruited to wage violent jihad for the militant group, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. He died last week on the Syrian battlefield with the extremist he called my bros. For the estimated 100 Americans who've traveled to Syria to wage jihad, said Michael Daly in the dailybeast.com, the lure is simple. At home, they were losers. But as members of ISIS, they're immersed in the excitement and glamour of AK-47s, beheadings, and holy war. If you guys only knew how much fun we have over here, gushed one American convert who had joined jihadists in Somalia. This is the real Disneyland. Not all recruits are poor, said The Economist in an editorial. Some of the 3,000 Western jihadists in Syria and Iraq, like Abdel Majed Abdel Bari, the 23-year-old Londoner suspected of beheading the American journalist James Foley, were middle class in their home countries. Many were not even particularly religious. In propaganda videos and tweets, many of the Western recruits are pictured eating sweets or splashing in seized swimming pools, giving naive young Muslims the impression that jihad is not unlike a student holiday, without the booze. Once they've made their decision to join in the fun, these Western fighters buy a one-way ticket to Istanbul and are smuggled over the Syrian border, where they can be slaughtering kuffar, or unbelievers, within days. What is pushing these youths into violence? Asked Daniel Hannon in telegraph.co.uk. To a disaffected young man who's had trouble fitting into society, fanatical Islam teaches that he is angry not because there's something wrong with him, but because there's something wrong with everyone else. But in a country full of disaffected young men, how do we identify those made in the USA jihadist? Asked Savannah Morning News in an editorial. The gleeful killers now rampaging through Syria and Iraq could become tomorrow's murderers in America. Down Syndrome, A Life Worth Living. Richard Dawkins may consider himself smarter than nearly everyone else, said Elizabeth Picuito in the dailybeast.com, but he would fail Philosophy 101. The controversial British evolutionary biologist is fond of issuing moral pronouncements from the ivory tower of his new atheism, and last week he outdid himself. When an expectant mother asked Dawkins via Twitter what she should do if she discovers that her fetus has Down syndrome, he gave her this chilling advice: abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring into the world if you have the choice. You don't have to be pro-life to be offended by Dawkins' cold-blooded utilitarianism, which presumes that Down syndrome renders a life so wretched it's not worth living. That presumption is demonstrably wrong, said Jamie Edgen and Fabian Fernandez in the New York Times. Despite the challenges faced by children with Down syndrome and their parents, studies have found that these families are often happier than those confronting other developmental disabilities, and sometimes as content as families with non-disabled children. In a survey of 284 people over age 12 with Down, 99% stated that they were personally happy with their own lives. Furthermore, by claiming it is immoral to give birth to a child with a disability, the self-proclaimed humanist implies that some other humans are clearly better than others, said Giles Fraser in The Guardian. But an athletic straight-A student isn't better than one with disabilities. He's just different. Dawkins' fundamental mistake was turning a choice into an obligation, said Emma Title in Maclean's.ca. An estimated 74% to 90% of pregnant women who are notified that their fetuses have Down choose to get abortions. The right to choose properly gives them that option. But to insist that women must abort any less than perfect child smacks of eugenics and undermines the cause of choice. Personally, I'm grateful to atheism's high priest, said Max Wynne Cowie in the Catholic Herald. With his brutal honesty, he has shown us where we're headed. In a world where parents are obliged to abort imperfect babies to minimize trouble, cost, and heartache, we will inevitably come to believe it is selfish for the old, sick, and useless to live on, rather than embrace assisted suicide. We should look upon the professor's words with a chill down our spine. And a few short notes for you. Nearly 50% of all Syrians have been forced to abandon their homes because of the civil war, according to a new UN report. About 3 million Syrians have fled the country, while another 6.5 million have moved from village to village. At least 5 current and 1 former police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, have been named in federal civil rights lawsuits alleging excessive force, with cops accused of pistol whipping a child, choking and hog tying a child, and beating a man who is charged with damaging city property because he bled on officers' clothes. The sale of assault rifles has fallen as much as 70% in 2014. The primary reason? The NRA was so successful in defeating gun control legislation after the Sandy Hook massacre that gun enthusiasts no longer think the government will ban these weapons. There's not an immediate fear the government's going to take them away, said a Georgia gun store owner. About 17,000 apartments and homes housing up to 400,000 people in Gaza were destroyed in the 7-week war between Hamas and Israel. On the poll watch, 31% of Americans say the U.S. does too little to address global problems, up from 17% a year ago. 39% say we do too much, down from 51% last year. And we'll finish with a quote from Margaret Atwood. "I've never understood why people consider youth a time of freedom and joy. It's probably because they've forgotten their own." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.